Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein with my co-host Ashley Thornburg.
Hello.
We woke up to the bridge collapse this morning in Baltimore. Hard to watch.
It's so thankful that it happened at the time of day that it did, and that there was the ability to stop some traffic.
A little bit of warning, maybe.
Area. Yeah, a lot of discussion in the newsroom today. Our colleague Eric Dethridge from that area. And so I know most of our listeners, including all of us here, definitely paying attention to NPR as that story develops.
On today's Main Street, Ashley, in the second half of the show, we'll visit with Bill Peterson. Really enjoyed that conversation. He's the director of the State Historical Society of North Dakota. And he shares, of course, his insights on preserving the state's heritage.
But leading off today's show is an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show with host John Harris as he visits with Dr. Michelle Lewicka, a professor of religion at Concordia College. And she talks about the importance of Women's History Month and the relevant courses that she teaches.
As we get started, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and maybe your background and where you're originally from.
Well, let's start with where I'm originally from. I grew up in Staples, Minnesota, and I spent the first 18 years of my life there. Then I went to the College of St. Benedict and kind of fell in love with learning. Felt like I couldn't stop, and I went on to graduate school at Harvard Divinity School and did my Master's of Theological Studies there. And then I was the first student to graduate in a program, a PhD program focused on religion, gender, and culture.
March, of course, is Women's History Month. Can you talk about some of the classes you teach at Concordia that focus on women's history and roles in society and things like that?
Yeah, probably the course that's most relevant to Women's History Month that I teach is women's religious history. So religion is my home field, and I have an emphasis in gender and women's studies. And that class is I say this about all my classes, but it really is one of my favorite classes to teach. I usually get a handful of men in the class. It fulfills a requirement, so that helps, and lots of women, some in between, students who are non-binary. And it's just a wonderful class for me to teach because I get to witness students encountering the history of women in a way that they haven't. We don't send students to high school and they learn about the history of women. They learn about history, which is so often his story. It's not really her story. So much of what we inherit historically is written by the historical winners. Men have been in the dominant position. And so women don't learn about their own history. And especially we start that class looking at the history of women in early Christianity. And many of the students, not all of my students are Christian. I would say about 50, maybe 60% of them are. But whether or not they're Christian, they're shocked to really find out about women's active role at the beginning of Christianity, because that's not a history that we learn about, either in the context of religion usually, or more broadly. So I think one of my favorite things about that class is students start to really see how patterns, specific patterns of gender norms and gender narratives that are historical, continue to echo in their own experiences. So, for example, a lot of the writings we have about women are just that. They're about women. They're not by women. And they're often very demeaning towards women. The early church fathers talk about how women are not very rational and they're not very trustworthy and they are profound sources of temptation, always leading men off the path. These are narratives that are still alive today. A lot of women doubt their own intelligence. They doubt their own ability to lead. They doubt their own sense of self. And the self-doubt that these historical narratives generate about women echoes in my students' experiences, particularly the young women who want to feel brave and want to feel confident, but they realize they struggle with self-doubt. And where does that come from? They weren't born with it. That's a historical legacy.
Why is it important to mark and observe Women's History Month?
Yeah, because if we don't know our history, we don't know our experience. We don't know how we came to be who we are. Simone de Beauvoir, she was a groundbreaking feminist in the middle of the 20th century. She was responsible for saying, one is not born a woman, one becomes a woman. In other words, so much of gender is socialization. of course, there are physiological differences, but so much of what we learn about what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman, these are social narratives. That's what it means to say gender is socially constructed. So Simone de Beauvoir said that if we don't know our history, there's a whole piece of self-knowledge that's missing collectively as women. And so understanding our history and understanding not just history from the perspective of what men said about women, but the more we can even dredge up stories that and self-representations that women in history had about themselves and their struggles in what predominantly has been patriarchal cultures, we learn about our own agency. We learn about other women's agency. We learn about how they challenged social norms in ways that made it possible for us to be on this trajectory, hopefully, I'm hopeful, that we continue transforming society towards a more equal future.
Can you talk about maybe how, in our lifetime, jobs and roles have changed for women?
I see more and more young women being more audacious in the best sense of the word, like brave, courageous in charting their own paths. But certainly doors have opened to women in jobs that used to be almost exclusively for men. If you look back in the 1950s and you went into the jobs wanted part of the newspaper, you'd see jobs for women and jobs for men. Gender segregated jobs. That's how, you know, it used to be. And now we don't do that anymore. Women are getting college degrees at a rate even slightly higher than men. And so they're going into jobs that were exclusively male territory or almost exclusively for much of human history and Western history. Think about women becoming doctors, lawyers, teachers. And at the same time, men are going into fields that have traditionally been relegated to women. Nursing, teaching, et cetera. Still not at the rates where it's 50-50. But I see young women also being going into like jobs that involve technology and some of those things that people in my generation have less fluency in. A lot of young women are very confident with those types of jobs, and I see them being very entrepreneurial about them.
So it sounds like you believe progress has been made in recent decades for equal pay and opening doors for women to careers that maybe they weren't. But what more can be done, in your opinion, in the coming years?
Lots more needs to be done. I don't want to give the impression that we're there yet. And when we think about it, think about even women in leadership positions. In Congress today, we have 28% of Congress is women. Now, that's progress, but is that even close to half? No, it's not even close to half. So what can be done? I think we need to, first of all, understand that there still is a problem. We've made progress, but there's still a problem of gender inequity, systemic gender inequity. And when you talk about sexism as something that's systemic, what that means is it's not a matter of our personal intentions. It's not that some people don't like women. There are people who maybe don't like women, but not many. Most of us have, you know, mothers and sisters and partners. But what can be done is we can admit that there still is a problem. There still is systemic gender inequality. And once we recognize that problem, we can look for ways in our own daily lives that we cannot be complicit with that. The same is true with racism. We're asking these questions. You know, as a white person, I'm trying to understand what are the ways I've been complicit with racism. One of the ways is I haven't had to think about it. You know, I've had the privilege, part of white privilege is not having to think about it. So I think one thing that can be done is men can join the struggle against sexism and see it as their problem too. I'm not just a women's studies professor, I'm a women and gender studies professor. So the men in my class, we talk about how patriarchy, namely the system of male dominance, is not good for them either. I had a really interesting conversation 2 weeks ago with students in my Christianity and Religious Diversity course. And we were reading this book where the author is making the case against sexism, but she's also saying that patriarchy is not good for men. And I asked the male students in the class, what do you think about this? And they opened up so beautifully about the struggles of what it's like to be having to live up to this image of manhood that feels really oppressive to them. And what if they don't fit into that? And think of all the pressure to be successful. And what if you're not successful? So I think until people who are in the dominant group see the kind of oppression that they're implicated in as their problem too, until white people see racism as their problem, until men see sexism as their problem too and not just a women's issue, we won't make progress. But I'm hopeful. When I teach, this is maybe why I teach college students, they're at a place in their lives where they're open to seeing things change and seeing things differently. And when we see things differently, then we have a chance to change.
Talk some about your publications and research. I understand you've done some on body images for women.
You know, it's funny, it strikes some people as funny that as a religion scholar, my focus, primary focus for the past three decades has been looking at body image and eating disordered behavior among women. And then I remind people who find that to be peculiar about the story of the second creation myth, the story of Adam and Eve, and how sin comes into the world. Do you remember that story? Mm-hmm. How does sin come into the world? Eve takes a bite. It's actually a fruit. It's described as a fruit, but the artistic tradition makes us all believe it's an apple. Anyway, it could have been. Who knows? It's a story. Religion scholars see this as a myth, not as something that really happened. But yeah, she eats. She eats. So sin and shame and death come into the world through a woman's disobedient appetite. This is goes back to the first question. If we don't really study the way that these historical narratives continue into today, we're missing something important. And so my interest in women's eating issues comes from my own experience having an adolescent eating disorder. But I started studying when I was at Harvard Divinity School what many of the religious authorities who were male were saying about women's bodies and about women's appetites. And the constant narrative kept going back to Eve, and women couldn't control their appetites, and women were out of control, and their bodies were unruly, and they needed to contain their bodies, and they needed to contain their hunger. I was like, this is so interesting, connecting the dots between this, one of the most influential myths in Western culture, right, is the creation myth. And at the heart of that myth is sin and shame being associated with women's bodies, and in particular, their bodily appetites. And so when I started doing research on this, it was so clear to me that that shame, that legacy of shame still is alive. I talk to my students about this all the time. It's one of my favorite topics is, you know, are you still all struggling with body image stuff? Oh yeah, they are. Even though they know it's toxic, even though they know that they've been fed a bed of lies about their bodies, they still really struggle. And now with social media, of course, that isn't helping the situation because they're exposed to all kinds of curated, edited, perfected images, and they struggle with shame.
Do you feel teachers, counselors, and others are better now than in past decades at spotting eating disorders and eating issues among women and young girls?
Yeah, to some extent, maybe. But also, you know, one of the most prominent eating disorder is binge eating disorder. And that's often done in secret. And so that's hard to spot. My own experience as an adolescent started off with a lot of self-starving, but then I became bulimic. And that's pretty easy to hide. You know, I went for 3 years with nobody knowing what was going on for me. And I think it's hard to spot certain eating disordered behavior, especially in a culture where eating disorders we have on the extreme part of the continuum, but then we also celebrate diet culture and weight loss. We compliment a woman who has lost weight until she's gone too far, and then we pathologize her. So to some extent, I think we've gotten better, but I also think it's hard to spot disordered eating in a culture that's already got so much disordered eating.
Who are some of your heroes as we celebrate Women's History Month?
I think about Sojourner Truth, a mid-19th century former slave who was, her slave name was Isabella, but she didn't like her slave name because that was not a name that she gave herself. And so she chose the symbolic name of Sojourner Truth, pursuing truth. And she went up and down the coast lecturing about the brutalities of slavery. And at a famous convention in 1851, there were some ministers, some Christian ministers there. It was a women's rights convention, and she was one of the few black women there. And these ministers were talking about how women shouldn't have rights because Jesus was a male and women weren't smart enough and Eve caused the whole downfall of humanity. So those are the reasons. And in the context of that conference, Sojourner Truth stood up and said, basically, I hear a bunch of people talking about women's rights, but am I even included in that as a black woman? And I think we're still struggling with that today. Right. But then she went on and gave these brilliant responses to the ministers saying, you know, you're saying I can't, women can't have rights because Jesus was a man. Well, where did Jesus come from? Jesus came from a woman. And then she says about the argument against women's intelligence. She says, you know, if she makes a clever argument against what the ministers are saying. And finally, she's arguing against their claim that women can't have rights because of what Eve did. And she says, you know, if Eve was powerful enough to bring down the whole of humanity, she must be pretty powerful. And I think she has the power, and women have the power to flip it and make it right again. So she's a hero of mine because she's brilliant. She's audacious. Her legacy, I think, lives on in women who are willing to be brave and audacious today against those kinds of ridiculous arguments that want to contain us.
What are some of the shocking things young women who attend your classes learn about things that women couldn't do not that long ago? I mean, you back up 100 years ago, the right to vote, but even a bank account or having their name on a credit card.
Yeah, you know, women were not able to have a bank account in their own name until like 1950. Think about credit cards. It was 1974. A woman could have a credit card in her own name. And this goes back to the legacy of women basically being property. It's not that long ago that these things were happening. I was saying I was about 10 years old when women could get a credit card in their own name. So that's during my lifetime. I want to bring in intersectionality, which is a way of talking about the way you can never talk about gender in isolation from talking about race and class and sexuality and other ways that we create identities in our culture. And women were, black women were not even allowed to be in the Miss America pageant until the late 60s because black was not considered beautiful. It bespeaks the power of Sojourner Truth's legacy, this power of claiming herself in that category of woman as a black woman and saying, we belong here too.
So if people are interested in getting more information, where can they go? Who can they contact?
Concordia has a wonderful Women in Gender Studies program. In fact, we have a number of Women in Gender Studies minors, and they connect their minors with whatever their major is. Our director is currently on sabbatical, so I'm happy to field any questions or have more discussions about these conversations, and I'm just on the website at Concordia College.
That was Dr. Michelle Lewicka with Prairie Pulse host John Harris. You can catch the entire episode this Thursday at 8 o'clock Central on Prairie Public Television. Coming up next, an excerpt from the Great American Folk Show as Tom Brosseau visits the Minot Curling Club.
For North Dakota's official state sport, curling, it used to be not BYOB, bring your own beer, but BYOR, bring your own rocks.
Up until probably the mid to late 40s, you had to own your own curling rocks before a club would provide them.
Saddle up to the bar, which looks down at the curling club in North Dakota's magic city of Minot. It won't take long to notice a rather large wooden box, or crate, if you will. It's called the Rock Box, and it houses two very heavy stones engraved with the name of a somewhat famous citizen.
The name on it is W.S. Shaw from Minot, and he was a mayor of Minot in 1918. But it's kind of the history of curling was you had to have your own rocks, and they weren't always uniform. They weren't all the same, and so that created some differences in how they bounced off one another and how they traveled on the ice.
That's Mark Hildahl. He's an avid curler, and he has deep-rooted connections to one of North Dakota's oldest curling clubs, which kind of reminds me, actually, of a Canadian rec room. We're at the fourth location, which is across from the Motor Speedway on the site of the State Fairgrounds. Over the years, flooding and a fire and a shifting ground forced changes in venues. But one of the unique things about this place is that some of the electricians and painters who built the cavernous gabled roof hall, they're also the members. And the place is thriving.
In the last several years, we've had an influx of young curlers. I think curling showed up again in the Winter Olympics. It's been on television. There's been some interest created that way. Curling has grown nationwide and worldwide in some fashion. And so we've taken advantage of that and grown our club back up now to, you know, 150 to 180 members.
Mark, who serves as treasurer and has been part of the Minot Curling Club for 62 years, remembers watching his father curl in the 1950s when the club was located at Riverside Park.
hanging around the old Minot Curling Club. I wasn't old enough and strong enough at the time. I was about 10 years old. I couldn't get a rock to the other end, but I was learning how to sweep, and I was watching the game and learning the game as an observer. We used to hang out there, and there was lots of other kids there too whose parents were curling.
Curling is everything in a place like Minot. Long winters, time between outdoor recreation activities, a Bonspiel boost to the economy. But when you check out the photos of the Minot Curling Club, you can tell it's totally social, connective city tissue.
It was important that the inside ice or the facilities were there to make it work so somebody could commit to something for a 5 to 6 month period and work at getting better, work at having more social interactions, having competitions, and getting out of the house, let's say, another night a week or so. So I think it was important to have something that people could count on.
A sport of good sportsmanship, where the winners often treat the losers to food and drink after the game, curling has sure come a long way since the mayor of Minot had to haul 2 40-pound rocks and a huge crate. Nobody has to lug 100 pounds to play anymore. The only thing heavy was the lift at making this space successful.
We're really still proud of the fact that the curling club members paid for half the cost of this building, as well as all the ice making equipment. The county fair paid for the remaining part, provided the land, and provided some of the funds for building the building. The curling club now leases the building back from the state fair. The curling club also maintains the club room, maintains the ice making equipment, and pays the utilities during the 6 months that we're here. So we have a big commitment to make a nice place to create some activities on the fairground.
That's Mark Hildahl of the Minot Curling Club.
That was Tom Brousseau's segment, Throwing Rocks at the Minot Curling Club. You can listen to the Great American Folk Show on Saturdays at 5 p.m. on Prairie Public. Next, the Coteau Slope in this natural North Dakota.
We generally regard the portion of North Dakota northeast of the Missouri River as glaciated, while the area southwest of the Missouri River has an unglaciated or erosional topography. That is, however, a broad generalization. The boundary between the glaciated topography and the unglaciated or erosional topography along the Missouri River is not easily or clearly defined. There are, for example, some areas east of the Missouri River that show little evidence of glaciation, while there are some glacial erratics, rocks moved by glaciers, west of the Missouri River. Many maps of North Dakota's surface geology, for example in the book North Dakota's Geological Legacy by John Bloomley, former state geologist and director of the North Dakota Geological Survey, shows a narrow band of land adjacent to the Missouri River on the north and east that is characterized by a mixture of glacial and erosional features. That landscape is what geologists call the Coteau Slope. It's an area of rolling hilly plains near the margins of the glaciers during the last ice age. Some of the glacial deposits here are comparatively thin and didn't significantly alter the topography. Perhaps the best place to view and better understand the geology of the Coteau Slope is to drive Highway 83 between Minot and Bismarck. The landscape between Minot and near Lake Audubon is typical for glaciated country. The topography is rolling to hummocky. Rock piles are conspicuous in many fields, and prairie potholes are evidence that the area was glaciated. But the landscape takes on a different character along much of Highway 83 from roughly Lake Audubon to Bismarck, and even more so between Wilton and Bismarck, with its broad sweeping landscape and occasional outcrops of bedrock. You'll not see many rock piles in the fields, and few if any prairie potholes along that stretch of highway. The Coteau Slope is also noticeable in several other areas along the Missouri River, as well as along Highway 83 southward from Bismarck to the South Dakota border. So the next time you travel on Highway 83 between Minot and Bismarck, or other areas along the east side of the Missouri River, make a point to take a little closer look at the landscape of the Coteau Slope. Some parts have easily identified evidence of glaciation, while other areas, well, not so much. Hopefully you'll get a better understanding and appreciation for North Dakota's geological heritage. I've put links to more information on the Coteau Slope and North Dakota geology, along with a text of this natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
That was a Natural North Dakota essay from biologist Chuck Lura. Chuck was a longtime biology professor at Dakota College at Botno, and in his retirement, he continues to share his Natural North Dakota essays for our Prairie Public audience. Still to come, our interview with the State Historical Society. But first this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg with Craig Blumenschein.
Ashley, yes. Next on our show today is my interview with Bill Peterson. He's the director of the State Historical Society of North Dakota. His charge? To preserve our state's heritage.
Dr. Peterson, welcome to Main Street.
Good morning, Craig. Please just call me Bill.
Bill, before we begin, I want to hear your red bike story. It has to do with the Edmund Fitzgerald. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's a true story. Red bike moments are something that the Muhammad Ali Center in Louisville, Kentucky asked people to document. It's basically, it says, you know, something in your youth that changed your life. And for Muhammad Ali, it was the stealing of his red bike. And so his red bike kind of defined him and put him on a path of boxing. And so my red bike moment was finding wreckage from the Edmund Fitzgerald in 1976.
You grew up in Michigan, correct?
I did. I grew up in Michigan, and we spent summers up on the southeastern shore of Lake Superior. So in the spring of 76, or the summer of 76, my cousins and I and my sister and grandparents found some of this wreckage. And I had been around, you know, the Great Lakes my entire life, and we'd had up in that part of the world, there was some shipwreck things on the shore and, you know, evidence of this sort of much different maritime heritage than the steel bulk carriers that were there. So we'd been around this, but the finding of the Fitzgerald wreckage, you know, really put me on a path of wanting to learn as much as I could about Great Lakes maritime history and ultimately the United States Life-Saving Service. So it did. It put me on a path that I've been unable and unwilling to change ever since.
Your office plays a significant role in North Dakota's National History Day program. Tell me what you do for it.
We're the state sponsor. We're the sponsor of the National History Day. And so National History Day is a scholastic contest across the nation where students can produce exhibits based on history. You can do documentaries, websites, or dramatic presentations. And then each, you know, student or group of students can do a project. They compete in a statewide competition, and first in a local competition, and then a statewide competition, and the successful ones at the state competition get forwarded on to Washington, D.C. So it's a fantastic program for students that love history and want to also share that with other folks. The other area that you can do is a research paper. So each year, the National History Day Office in Maryland issues the theme for the year. Students then in the fall generally kind of take that theme. They find something in their area of interest or something that they're interested in that fits into that theme, and then they build their projects.
Bill, America 250, an exhibition is coming to North Dakota in 2025. What is that?
We're coming up on a commemoration of the founding of the United States. We're having a birthday. And so we're coming up on 250 years. Some states are doing exhibits and programming that will allow us to take a look at that birthday and figure out what that looks like. So it's an opportunity for us in North Dakota to pause and reflect on the nation's past, honor the contributions of our citizens, and then look toward the North Dakota we want for the next generation.
How will that play out?
We're going to take a lot of time to talk about personal stories and find out how or what people's ancestors were doing 250 years ago.
More to come from your office on how to participate.
Much more, yep. There's also a state, America 250 Commission that was set up by the legislature. We're in the process of formalizing that and seeing how that program looks across the state, right? What can we do at the State Historical Society and the state government to help communities commemorate this really significant birth?
Bill, you and your office are directly involved in the Military History Museum that is coming to the Capitol campus. How's it coming? And what's the timeline?
The timeline is probably opening, I would say, in 2027. This has been a collaboration with the North Dakota National Guard. We've been working with them literally since 2020 to get the museum concepted and built. So we're in the process now of we've got some preliminary drawings. We're in the process of entering into the schematic design and hiring a firm that will build the exhibits for the addition to the Heritage Center. So it will be an integrated part of the State Historical Society and the Heritage Center with this collaboration of the National Guard to recognize all branches of the military in North Dakota.
I'm curious, Bill, you mentioned social media just a moment ago, and of course that didn't exist in your world maybe what, a decade, two decades ago.
Right.
How do you work with that relative to being able to present things to people in their space relative to the way things were presented a long time ago?
I've got a saying around here that I say often is our product is our process. And what it has allowed is for us to kind of pull back the curtain in a lot of our ways. So if you look at a lot of our blog posts, social media posts, a lot of those are a peek behind some of the scenes here at the Heritage Center and at the State Historical Society out on our sites. To see things that you may not normally see, just by going through the gallery. So it's been a really great way to engage people at a different level than we have or museums in the past have been able to engage with them.
Enjoying our conversation with Dr. Bill Peterson. He's the director of the State Historical Society of North Dakota. The State Historical Society operates several historic sites, and I'm real curious which of these sites you find personally resonant with you and why?
It's a hard question to answer, right? I have affinity for quite a number of our sites, right? So I'll start with, I grew up in an Air Force town. So when I go to our site in Cooperstown, the missile Oscar Zero, the Ronald Reagan Minuteman missile site, I find that to be a curiously familiar time capsule. So I appreciate that in that way. But I also, you know, really enjoy all of our sites. The Medora, the chateau and the craftsmanship and some of the structures around there and its history as a state historic site are almost as fascinating as the fact that the marquee and the town are named after the marquee's wife and why they were there to raise cattle with, you know, Teddy Roosevelt and everything else. I find the history there just to be pretty great. And then, you know, the Missouri Yellowstone confluence is just a really great part of our geography and a different way to see the world. You know, there's so many of our sites are humbling, right? When you go to the, like any of our Double Ditch Indian settlements or Huff on the river, you know, further south, Fort Clark, they're just very humbling, right? A lot of people don't talk about this, but North Dakota has, you know, punched above its weight in so many categories for so many centuries. These historic sites just kind of remind us of that. Remind me of that every day.
One of the things I've realized, Bill, is that I didn't pay enough attention when I was younger to what my state of Wyoming had to offer relative to its history. And now all of a sudden that I'm older, it's just like, gosh, I should have paid more attention and things. So I'm curious, have you found that younger people in North Dakota are genuinely interested in our state's history and your office's work to preserve that history?
Yeah, I think a couple of things that you said are true, right? History, we tend to age into it, which I think is not a surprise to anyone. When you're younger, a year is a much bigger part of your life than it is when you're past a certain point, right? So when you're five, a year is a fifth of your life. When you're 55, it's not the same, right? So we look at time and the passage of it a little differently. And I think as we lose some of the people in our lives that had been important to us, we end up appreciating them in a different way. And I think that shows in how some people approach history as they get older. But I have found that kids, young people, by and large, are really, really interested in history when they're approached with it in the correct way, right? So if you can engage kids in an exciting way and things that they're interested in, I think kids are really great proponents of not only history but also just big fans of it.
Bill, the State Historical Society of North Dakota, as you well know, has a notable collection of artifacts and archives. And I want to ask you two questions about that. First, can you talk about any particular item in the collection that you find especially fascinating or that residents of our state would also find just really fascinating?
We have 80,000 numbered objects in our collection and about 10 miles of archives, you know, which stacked up the skinny way plus, you know, 2 million historic photographs and more than a million feet of film, moving picture in our archives. So it's hard to pick out one single thing. You know, I tend to view some of my favorites more holistically, right? Taking combined, there's nowhere in the world you can get a better, more complete grasp of everything that North Dakota represents than here at the State Historical Society. There are a couple of individual objects that I think are sort of resonating to me in working with some of the folks in the military and getting ready for the military gallery opening and doing some of the research on that. I spent a little bit of time in our gallery with Admiral Munch, who's an admiral in the Navy and native of Oaks. And he showed me some things in our collection because he knew they were there. And I'll forget the captain's name, but there was a submarine captain in World War II that sank the Japanese aircraft carrier, the Shinano. The Shinano was an aircraft carrier that was built in complete secrecy late in the war. And this young officer in the Navy had been given a command of a submarine, and he, on his own, decided that he wasn't quite ready for command. And he then asked himself, or he asked the Navy to give him a shore duty for a while until he was ready. And then in a couple of years, he went back and asked for command again. And the Navy granted that, which Admiral Munch informed me was really very unique. And at the time, and so on his first trip out with a submarine, he saw this massive carrier that it had been built in so much secrecy the United States was unaware of its construction, and so he sank it on its maiden voyage, and so we have some of his insignia from his uniform. We've got his dolphin and some of the other things. So it's a fascinating. There's so many stories like that. Are in our collection, that goes on and on and on, just one story after another about these amazing North Dakotans and the people that they did. Linda Slaughter, she founded the Bismarck Ladies Historical Society, and we've got a quilt in our collection that was given to her as she left Ohio to come to North Dakota. And it was, as I understand it, these quilts were oftentimes they were made by members of her family, and then they would embroider or stitch their initials into parts of the quilt that they made. And this was a way of saying goodbye to her, because they, it was in all likelihood they never expected to see her again, because at that time, you move from Cadiz, Ohio, to Bismarck, North Dakota, that's like traveling around the world. We don't see it that way today, because it's a 2 or 3 day car drive. But at that point in time, when that happened, she formed the Historical Society in, I think, 1889. It was a major journey, and the chances of getting back, were pretty slim. So I find stories like that and things like that compelling. We have, story after story that we have stuff in our archives that talk about, what North Dakota was like. And it's just the state history and the things that our forebears went through to give us modern North Dakota was just spectacular. So I'm enamored with almost everything that I see in our collection. I could walk the galleries and the halls and talk about it for forever. I'm particularly fascinated with Paleo-Indian projectile points from the Paleo era, which is 11 to 13,000 years ago. Those people made a living here hunting mastodons and giant bison. They produced the spectacular stonework. The idea that humans and mastodons were interacting in North Dakota 13,000 years ago is just remarkable to me, and that the mastodons at the time were probably going extinct. I've been told that it's probably because of the change in climate due to the glaciers receding and the world warming at the time. And if you can imagine that you'd hunted these things for generations, and then to see your main food source going extinct for whatever reasons, I think that the conversations around the fire and the communities just would have been all about that.
Sure.
I find these stories fascinating, right? We can't really go back and know what the conversations were, but they had to have been profound.
Well, that actually leads to the second part of the question that I have about your collections of artifacts and archives. Where I lived, adjacent to the Wind River Indian Reservation in Wyoming, there was, I think, some friction with where artifacts were stored. In fact, Wyoming PBS did a documentary about people from the reservation going to the Chicago Field Museum to see their own artifacts. And then the question became, Why? Why did they need to go there to see artifacts that really were theirs? What is your relationship with the Native American tribes here in North Dakota relative to many artifacts that are here?
Sure. Well, probably this agency's longest partnership in the state is with the MHA Nation. We've been partnering with them for almost since our inception to preserve history and do history. We partner with the tribes in regards to the each nation has tribal historic preservation offices. So we work with them on a regular basis to collaborate in things where we share interests. You know, I think we have a great working relationship with our tribal partners, and the agency has been caretaking a number of, a large collection of Native American goods for many years. Those relationships and the nature of those things are changing, you know, so as communities like Newtown build, you know, heritage centers of their own, I expect to see a lot of the material that has been stored here, you know, stored up there back with the communities that produced it.
Tell me, Bill, how does the society decide on new exhibitions, and is there anything you can kind of give us the quick pre-story about what we can look forward to in the coming year or two?
Oh, sure. Well, we have a whole exhibits, you know, program and overseen by a woman named Kim Jondal, who's our director of audience engagement and museums. And so that part of the team does a lot to decide, you know, what exhibits are going to be going where. We've got a lot of state historic sites that will be getting some upgrades to their exhibits. So there's a Prairie Post Office exhibit that's going to be going to Pembina here before too long. And so here at the Heritage Center, we'll have an art exhibit, North Dakota Art Part 2, which will be in the Spirit Gallery after the Marvelosity exhibit leaves. And there'll be an art gallery. There's in between the Governor's Gallery and the other gallery in the main hall of the Heritage Center, there's always an art exhibit. That'll be the Art of Making Do. In the fall, we'll partner with the North Dakota Department of Indian Affairs and produce the Native American Hall of Honor exhibit for the upcoming year. So those are a couple of things that are in the works. And of course, we're going to be working with the designers and the people to design the exhibits in the military gallery.
Kind of exciting times, it sounds like, quite frankly.
Indeed, yep, that's very exciting. So the military gallery will take up a lot of our time. You know, that story starts before Europeans were in North Dakota. Native communities had the equivalents of militaries, and I think of militaries, we tend to think of them as conducting war, but military war is just a fraction of what militaries actually do, you know. So native militaries, you know, were in charge of, you know, resources and that sort of thing, and protection, defense, and they all had societies there. And then, of course, after contact, you know, the militaries on both sides, European and Native, you know, interacted, you know, throughout North Dakota. And then, you know, it's a great story today with all of the participants, you know, in North Dakota's military from tribal communities. So yeah, that'll be a big story for us to get out there.
Bill, as we kind of wrap things up here just briefly, what are the biggest challenges that you have in front of you relative to historical preservation in the state?
You know, that's a really great question, and I think that bears some sort of nuanced discussion and some thought, right? There's resources that we can talk about, financial or human. You've got lots of things that are challenging, right? You've got technology moving very fast, and you know, historians need to learn to embrace technology and utilize it. You've got preservation of buildings. You know, we a lot of times new buildings are serve our needs better than an old building, you know, but they have their challenges too, right? So we've got to kind of walk those lines of what's possible, what's not possible, how do we continue to move forward and bring along with us the things that are most valuable and useful from the past to help us inform ourselves and our decision making today. So I think that's probably the big challenge is, you know, what do we bring forward with us as we navigate the complexities of the new world? We have donation boxes all over the Heritage Center. We have a foundation. The North Dakota State Historical Society Foundation has been an amazing partner for us. Dale Lennon is the executive director there, and his staff, Chris Hockett, they help us they help us with fundraising. They have their own board of directors. They've raised millions and millions of dollars in support of the state history in the course of their existence. So we're truly blessed that we have so many ways that people that want to, you know, change the world through an investment in us can easily do that.
Bill, if I'm in Bismarck, where should I go?
Well, I always tell people to come to the Heritage Center. We're open 8 to 5, free to the public, right? That's something that the legislature has made sure that anybody that wants to come here is able to be here. You know, and then state historic sites, they vary a little bit in their hours and admissions across the state. Generally, they're open, you know, in the summertime from Memorial Day to Labor Day, they're open 7 days a week. And with a usually pretty modest admission prices, we'll entertain people and educate them all day long. There's a lot of things to see in Bismarck. I will say I have a favorite, and I'm coming to the Heritage Center and the State Historical Society of North Dakota is something that I always find a little humbling. It's an amazing, very inspirational place to work.
Bill Peterson, he's the director of the State Historical Society of North Dakota and North Dakota State Preservation Officer. He and his staff play a significant role in preserving North Dakota's history and heritage. Bill, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
A major bridge collapse in Baltimore has wounded the city and shocked the nation. City and state officials are focused on responding to the current emergency.
There's no timetable right now on when things could be rebuilt or when things may reopen.
Get the latest on the Baltimore bridge collapse on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 26th. It was in 1914 that the first official state basketball tournament was played in North Dakota. All participating schools played in one class. The champions from four districts went on to the state championship. The Fargo team won that very first tournament in games played in Fargo at the North Dakota Agricultural College. For 1933, a two-class system was adopted. Larger schools became Class A, and Class B teams were created for schools with lower enrollments. The first Class B basketball tournament was played in Valley City. It was a close one, as Fairmont beat Candu in overtime. Despite the separation, Class A and B teams could still mix. In fact, a Class B team could challenge a Class A team during the district battles, and if they won, they could enter the Class A tournament. Various Class B teams accepted the challenge, and in 1935, the Class B teams of Grafton and Wahpeton did make it into the Class A tournament. It was staged in Bismarck at the World War Memorial Building, and 250 extra seats were brought in to increase seating capacity, bringing the total well over the 3,000 mark. In the end, Class B Grafton won the Class A title, and Class B Wahpeton was the runner-up. Much was reported about this exciting result. The winning Grafton team received awards and was treated to a luncheon at the Capitol Building by the Grand Forks Commercial Club. John Burke, once governor, former U.S. treasurer, and then current Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court, was one of the prominent local figures who spoke at the luncheon. This was quite a result, but not unprecedented. The Bismarck Tribune noted that Grafton was the fourth school from Class B to snag the Class A title. Although L.A. White, secretary of the Board of Control and superintendent of schools at Minot, emphasized that none of the teams who had played in the Class A tournaments were truly considered Class B. He stated that as soon as a Class B team challenged a Class A team, they entered Class A. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us.
Coming up later on today's episode of The Daily with Michael Barbaro, the Department of Justice and its suit against Apple, the largest and most sweeping in a series of anti-monopoly cases. And tomorrow on Main Street, philosophical currents and the role of gossip. Now, hold your judgment. There is some value to gossip, and we talk about how it can actually build community. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.